British Spy Stories, Season 1. Spy or Traitor? Episode 18. Catherine has been restless for 2 days. More than anything, she wants to find Rich's lover, but London gave her a number of jobs to do, and she hasn't had any spare time. She feels as though her work has started to become monotonous over the last few weeks. The same loop of repetition. Kill order received, do some preparation and carry out the job, then hang around for days waiting to be called on again. She needs more stimulus than this. She sets an inquiry running on Oberon about London operations that mention Rich, his flat address, or his work address. Within 3 minutes, a list of ops is displayed on one of the two enormous screens which she insisted London provide for her for work, but they're more to do with her nighttime online gaming sessions. Killing in a virtual world, to take her mind off the reality of killing in the real world. Kate scans the operations list in the results, but nothing is directly relevant. The results are too broad and include anyone called Richard, who has been mentioned in reports across London, and any operations which involve the immediate vicinity around his flat and work addresses. She is starting to feel vaguely ridiculous with this search, and knows that the chase to find who her boyfriend slept with is futile. She just needs to dump him and forget him. The opportunity for revenge will never come up anyway. A message notification pops into the top corner of one of the screens, and she clicks to open it. It's from Agent Riverside, who she worked with a couple of years ago. He's on an op and needs C9 sniper backup. Can she come to Berlin so that he can brief her? He has already cleared her allocation with London and asked for her personally because he knows she is good from when they worked together previously. This is an opportunity to go somewhere different and do something different for at least a few days. It will take her mind off the stupid, jealous chase for an unknown woman. She replies that she'll be in Berlin tomorrow, then opens Call of Duty on her machine and plays until the early hours, killing into the night. The Met Bar has been quiet, even for a Tuesday. Hans sits on a tall stool with his feet up on the bar and flicks through his social media again to keep his brain awake. Two men sit around a table at the far end of the place discussing German football, and an old lady at another table reads a copy of Stern magazine. The door opens almost as if it had been blown by the wind. Riverside walks in and sits at the end of the bar. Hans feels his muscles tighten. "Hans," he says. The barman descends from his perch and walks towards him. "How did your meeting go?" says Hans. "I think you know." Hans shakes his head. "Did she turn up?"
"She did, as did two guests."
"A party, then. Always good to catch up with old friends." Hans smiles innocently.
"Did you tell anyone about our rendezvous, Gordon?
Are you accusing me of leaking secret information?"
"Someone said something," says Riverside, not moving his gaze from Gordon's face. "I don't break the rules. It's just only you and I knew," says Riverside.
"Must have been you, then.
How do you communicate with her, Gordon?"
"On a need-to-know basis, that's for sure."
"Well, I need to know," says Riverside.
"Didn't she give you her address when you met up?"
"Look, Gordon, we can stand here all day being stupid."
"Something you're used to," says Hans.
Riverside springs into life and brings his hand up to Gordon's arm, his fingers spread and pressed together just enough to hurt. Then they relax. Hans pulls his arm away.
"Is that standard protocol for talking to a colleague where you come from?" he says.
"You know where she is, Gordon, and I have a job to do."
"I don't know where she is, and I'm not sure I'd tell you now anyway." Why the loyalty? She could be the mole.
Riverside is getting annoyed now. She's done nothing wrong, says Hans. And I'm against heavy-handed internal operations that damage too many people and don't solve the problem.
I'm going to find her, you know I am. If you've looked me up on Oberon, you know I don't give up.
She's not your mole. She's trying to find the mole. Look, I can tell you what she suspects. There's been some suspicious comms between London and Berlin. She doesn't know who, but that's the focus of it. We've lost 3 agents in the field in a month, which means the leaks are regular and well-informed. It's not Gabby, and also, it's not one person. 2 nodes communicating to each other. Gordon intentionally omits the GISS photo evidence, as he doesn't trust the man in front of him.
Riverside considers the words that he's heard, and Hans walks off to collect glasses from tables and give the man some brain space.
Riverside's eyes land on Gordon's jacket, hanging on a peg behind the bar. He slowly gets up from his stool and walks to the end of the bar, pulls the coat off the hook, and goes through the pockets. He stuffs a fist into one pocket and pulls out a bar of chocolate and coins. As he does so, an airline ticket falls out and floats to the floor. He picks it up and unfolds it. The ticket is from Nice Côte d'Azur to Berlin, dated yesterday. He slips it into his palm.
Let me think about what you said, Hans.
He calls out as the man returns with a tray of empties.
Thanks, that was a useful chat.
The coolness of the day cascades through the open window above and behind Ella Peretz's desk. She shivers momentarily, pulls her jacket across her shoulders, and turns her head to the other window at the side of her and the yellowing trees outside. She scrolls the page on her tablet and rereads the statements from the witnesses on the Stranraer case. They're all consistent, maybe too consistent. Consistency means one of 2 things in her experience. They're all relating their views about real events and are telling the truth, or they have all agreed a story to tell and think that consistency is the best way for lies to look real. The truth is never the same from everyone, even those who witness the same event. 5 people seeing a road accident will all have slight variances in their memories of what happened. Their natural biases and predispositions will colour the way they see things and what they recall. It's her job to assess whether witness variations are natural or fabricated. Ella's mobile rings. It is Lawrence from Sir Bernard's office, calling her for the meeting they are going to with the Cabinet Office. She collects her things and throws them into her Mulberry Bayswater bag, a luxury that she bought for herself on her last birthday. Sir Bernard's Jaguar Sentinel idles just outside the rear door to Vauxhall Cross. Ella arrives on the ground floor and pushes out into the September day. She would normally have walked, but Sir Bernard believes that how you arrive is a significant part of your presence, as he tells her in the 10-minute journey along the river, past Thames House and around Parliament Square. They pull up into the secure entrance off Whitehall and are shown to a lift that takes them to the 3rd floor. Ella likes Vauxhall Cross, as it feels like a modern office. The Cabinet Office feels to her like something from an era long gone. She gets the tradition, but Victoriana doesn't talk to her soul. They are escorted through an outer office into the inner sanctum of the 2nd Permanent Secretary to the Cabinet Office, Sir Stuart Dunn. Sir Bernard and Dunn are old friends and have worked together on numerous high-profile security operations. Dunn outlines the matter that has come up. A barrister has raised a request for a witness statement from a member of MI6. Dunn already asked Ella's investigations department to research the case and in particular to find information on the source in 6 called Petrov.
There appears to be no such person, relates Dunn. Hence this meeting today to discuss and identify where we go from here. Ella goes through the searches that her department have carried out, looking for Petrov. They have run multiple cross-tabulated searches for real names, aliases, cover names, and operational code names, but nothing has come up. There was an Operation Petrol in 1984, and one agent had a passport alias of Peter Rover, but nothing apart from those. They discuss the information that was passed to the third-party contractor, who is represented by the barrister requesting access. The level of concern rises palpably in the room as they review the details of the secret operations in Slovenia that were supplemented with outside mercenaries. Dunn wants to know whether it is standard practice for the SIS to hand out state secrets to commercial companies, which Sir Bernard vehemently denies, and talks for 5 minutes non-stop on the rigour of the practices adopted in the European Operations Directorate. Dunn makes it perfectly clear that this is potentially explosive and looks like a leak of information. He reinforces that they need to find the Petrov character urgently. They retreat to the comfort of the Jaguar that has been waiting for them downstairs.
There, Miss Perez, you saw a wonderful example of Cabinet Office power play, says Sir Bernard, as they sit waiting to get out into the flow of traffic along Whitehall.
They're right, though, aren't they? She says.
That it looks like a leak?
Yes,
says Sir Bernard.
This could be an ugly one. I've seen this sort of thing before, where a small inquiry becomes a big snowball.
What do we do?
Petrov is obviously a cover name, says Sir Bernard. I suggest you talk to our sister security services in Europe and run some searches in their databases too. Maybe they have come across the name.
She types on her tablet.
Do we know if any lives were lost in these Slovenia operations?
She flicks through the documents on her screen and reads hurriedly.
Yes,
she says while still reading. Sir Bernard watches the people on Millbank as the car speeds up, then slows again as they negotiate the London traffic.
Yes, two lives lost, both agents of ours.
When was this?
7 months ago?
Sir Bernard is lost in his thoughts. His mind switches into damage limitation. If this has happened on his watch, then he needs to be seen to move quickly now the Cabinet Office is involved. Then he remembers the conversations on the Stranraer death and Black Hawk's belief in a mole. It is looking more and more likely that she may be right. What he needs to do urgently is to ensure that any mole is stopped dead in their tracks. Robinson arrives at the Sky Lounge rooftop bar and is shown to a table overlooking the Notre Dame de l'Assomption Basilica in Old Nice. He orders a Negroni and spends his time watching the women at the tables scattered across the space. Dima arrives 10 minutes later. They order more drinks and talk about the events at the Villeneuve-Loubet Marina. Lebedev is more trusting of Ulrich than Robinson, who hasn't shared the news of the fight in Ulrich's hotel room yet. But Lebedev can tell his friend is angry, and more angry than he has seen him before.
You need to chill, man, he says. Ulrich is a bastard, but in no way the attack was anything to do with him.
I don't know, says Larry. He stepped over the line this time.
It wasn't him, man, says Dima. The more interesting question is, who was it?
He has Robinson's attention.
Who could have done it? There's only ever three possibilities for ambushes. The cops, competitors, or someone inside the gang.
It wasn't me, says Robinson.
Nor me. What about your boys?
No way. They're all loyal, says Larry.
Mine too. We got competitors? Sure. But have we got competitors with the balls to screw us over? I don't think so. You, me, and Ulrich are respected. People know me because of my clubs and bars. What about you, Larry? You got someone trying to take over your patch?
Not me, man.
Robinson takes a swig of his drink and raises his hand for another.
So what do you think? Says Deemer. Who screwed us?
The cops didn't do that attack, says Robinson. It was way too clever. There was, what, 5 or 6 guys who attacked us? Those firebombs were pro, man.
So who?
Mercenaries, I reckon, says Larry.
Working for who, though? The gear went up in flames, so no one wins.
They talk into the evening, Robinson downing alcohol at twice the rate of Lebedev. He can't get past his belief that Ulrich is behind it all.
I got a plan, Deemer.
Yeah?
We top Ulrich, says Robinson.
Lebedev's face shows no emotion.
What do you think?
Take his patch,
says Deemer, turning to look at Larry. Robinson nods.
You should know I knifed him today.
You what?
Flesh wound, says Larry. But now, I'm gonna finish the job.
Fuck, you gotta be careful, Larry.
You in, or what?
Lebedev breaks the close intensity of their discussions and looks over the skyline to the setting sun. The scattered light draws long shadows of the church opposite that strike out across the deck of the bar where they sit. Deemer's mind isn't thinking about how they'd kill Ulrich. That is simple enough. He is running through the consequences of what Robinson has proposed. Crime is a distrustful business. When an opportunity rears its ugly head, it's always worth considering the pros and the cons.
What's the deal? He says. What split do you want of his businesses?
I hadn't thought.
Think now, man. Don't just be driven by revenge. Be driven by building up your portfolio. I'll take the clubs and the drugs business. You have the rest.
Larry nods.
What about the gun running? He says.
Yeah? And the migrants.
Robinson thinks for a second, but not in enough detail to give the options proper consideration. The air from the street glides across the table.
Let's do it. His eyes flick up to Deemer.
They talk about the details behind the broad plan that has emerged. Robinson's natural approach is emotional, wanting it all, and quickly. Lebedev is more circumspect and businesslike, and he wants Larry to realize that it's not just one death, it's controlling the businesses after that. There will be lieutenants within Ulrich's organization who won't like the takeover and will want a larger piece of the new operations. All even fight to take it all. Deemer has more experience of intergang fighting, controlling geographic patches and defending the borders of an operation. Robinson's criminal activity has been more piecemeal, old-school prostitution, and small-time drug trafficking. They eat, then part after the meal. Robinson is going on to a club, but Lebedev wants to go back to the hotel in case Ulrich is causing waves after the knife fight. Deemer drives back past Montbaron and Villefranche-sur-Mer before turning onto the Cap Ferrat headland. Ulrich hasn't sent him a message today, and he needs to know the state of Ulrich's mind. He'll want Robinson dead after the fight, that's for sure, and Deemer has an opportunity to back both men and guarantee being on the winning side, no matter what the outcome.